Oh, I broke it. Sorry.
Ooh.
All right, put it on my bill. May it please the court, Patricia Novotny, on behalf of Gregory Morris, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please. The procedural issue in this case is dispositive, but before I get to it, I would like to point out that the factual issue is just as compelling. In 2008 and 2012, the trial court ordered a downward deviation for this father's child support obligation in respect of the obligation he has to support his second family. Then, when the children became adults, the trial court quadrupled the father's child support obligation, ordering him to pay half the full freight for two children to the University of Washington. Most people cannot do that, and most people do not do that, and certainly my client cannot do that. He's in debt. He doesn't own a home. He doesn't have anything he can even borrow against to get himself out of this obligation. So I just like to make that point at the get-go.
All right. But since you've gone there, but he hasn't challenged the child support amount for the younger daughter under as a standard calculation. True?
As a minor child?
Right.
The calculation, but he received a downward deviation from that.
At the present time?
Correct.
And the post-secondary order for that child was not a challenge or appeal?
Oh, yes. Both the children, the post-secondary awards to both children are on appeal. That's the subject of this appeal, that the court doesn't have authority to award post-secondary education support to either child because the mother filed a motion for adjustment, not modification.
All right. Well, that's clear as to the older child, but frankly, I was under the impression you had not challenged it for the younger child. I'll go back and revisit.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry that's unclear. I mean, the trial attorney argues it as well in the only transcript that we have, which is the argument before Judge Darvas.
So what transpired here that was different than a petition for a modification other than the label on the form?
Well, the two proceedings are, of course, quite different. One is a full trial by affidavit, and one is a 14-day motion hearing. But, you know,
but
you
the
can...
The court offered your client all the time in the world, so what else is different?
The substance. There's no finding there's a substantial change of circumstances.
But this was an issue that was reserved by the trial court in the first instance. There's nothing to change. There was no decision made at the original decree. Why would there have to be a finding of substantial change of circumstance?
Because the reserving the issue doesn't decide the issue. It simply sets it aside. It defers any decision. So in 2008, they simply did not reach the issue.
But the point of a substantial change of circumstances is that something has changed and there's a decision that needs to be done. I mean, there was no denial of post-secondary. There was no grant of post-secondary. So the court just reserving jurisdiction to make the determination in the first instance?
I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure I follow your question. I mean, there was never been, the child support for post-secondary education was never ordered. So if it's never ordered, before a court can order, it has to modify the decree, and as a basis for modification, it has to find there's a substantial change in circumstances from the last order of child support and now.
Didn't they reserve post-secondary?
They reserved it, but what does reserve mean? We've argued that reserve simply means to defer. It isn't a factual decision, or the court did not make
that
decision.
No, I know that.
Yes.
So, I'm sorry. So they didn't come to an agreement at that point.
No, absolutely
about
not.
Post-secondary is your position.
Yes, there's absolutely no agreement to pay for post-secondary education in 2008. In 2008, they simply reserved it. And, of course, we do have this, you know, the forms that use that language, but the statute and all the case law is quite clear, and the definition of reserved is quite clear. Even the trial court actually said.
Where are you looking to the definition of reserved?
I look to a dictionary because it says it means to defer. You know, it doesn't decide.
There's not one in the statute. There's not one in the regs.
No.
Forms.
The word reserved isn't even used in the statute.
Right.
So,
counsel, we have a situation here where apparently the argument is somebody below used the wrong form to get the issue.
The trial attorney for the mother, or the mother,
the
correct,
court.
Filed the wrong proceeding. I wouldn't say just form.
Okay,
yes.
Well, here in the appellate court, you know that we have notices of discretionary review and notices of appeal, and there are different requirements for each. often we have a situation where somebody files the wrong form, but we treat it in the way it should be treated. Now, why isn't that kind of analysis equally applicable under these circumstances? In other words, you say it should have been a motion rather than something else.
Well, there are certainly instances where you don't want to elevate form over substance, but this is more in the nature of a statute of repose. And, you know, if a child reaches the age of majority and support terminates, you don't get to go back. And
sure, okay, it was a timely putting in of the papers.
That's right,
but the
wrong papers.
Your argument is the wrong papers. And so my question is,
right,
if you equate it to the notice of discretionary review, notice of appeal, timely application with a paper, but some problem with the paper, why shouldn't that kind of analysis apply here?
Well, because I think if you simply abrogate the statute. That's not what the statute
Why?
Says. Because the statute says you have to do a modification. Well, if you're just going to treat motions for adjustment, which are these truncated, short, accelerated sorts of review, mechanical almost, as if they were petitions for modification, you've simply done away with the distinction. Now, maybe that's where we wish the legislature would go, although I think not. But there's a huge difference here between these two proceedings. And, yes, the mother made a mistake. Do people pay for these kinds of mistakes? Yes. Do I feel her pain or her attorney's pain? I do. But I think that, you know, you have to be, you just don't have the authority any more than you do for enlarging the time limit to file a motion for reconsideration, for example. It's a statutory deadline, and she missed it. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Valerie Villison for the respondent, Kelly Reyes. One point I want to make is the difference between an adjustment and a modification. An adjustment is somewhat of a modification. The distinction is a full modification is considered something significant in nature, something not contemplated. And in this case, the 2008 order contemplated that these children would need post-secondary support. That's why it was reserved. This would be a different
situation. Well, that's different than agreed. So they contemplated. I think that's a...
They contemplated.
So, but they didn't
They expected
agree.
That post-secondary support would become an issue, which would need to be addressed in the future.
But they did not agree that post-secondary support would be ordered.
No, not necessarily, which is why they had to file some sort of motion, petition. They had to get it before the court, before either one of the children graduated from high school, which is exactly what they did here.
So they contemplated that issue needed to be resolved by some further...
Right,
proceeding.
But without having to show a substantial change in circumstance. This would be a different situation if the 2008 order said child support terminated when the child turned 18 or once the child graduated from high school, and that's it. And if it was silent about post-secondary support, or it said post-secondary support was not applicable, or post-secondary support was not ordered. Then, under those circumstances, sure, the mother would probably have to come in and show that there was a substantial change in circumstance, that, you know, lo and behold, our kids are smarter than we thought, and they could go to college. But in this case, the parties contemplated that post-secondary
the
children
contemplated that the two kids would go to college.
Correct, and that they would need support. And that at some point, before the oldest child turned or graduated from high school, they'd have to figure out how much they would be required to provide, whether
but,
it be...
But they wouldn't know at that time what their financial circumstances
would be. No, exactly, which is why they didn't do it 4 years earlier. At the point, the children were, I believe, 13 and 14. There was no point in trying to establish what each parent's support obligation for post-secondary support would be at that time, because presumably the parties' incomes would change. Also, they didn't know where the children would be going to school. In this case, this family is in an enviable position. They've got two smart, bright girls who got into the University of Washington, which, while not cheap, is, you know, more reasonable than most in-state schools or out-of-state schools, and the legislature just granted them a tuition freeze for the next 2 years. This is a great position for the parents to be in. The parents, they married young, they divorced young, but they've moved on, and they have successful careers where they each earn over $100,000 each. The problem here we have is not that the parents don't want to support. The father concedes in his pleadings. He wants to provide support for the children. But he, not unlike most divorced parents, doesn't want a court order requiring him to do so. But by doing that, the children are left at the whim of their father. Will he provide support? Won't he provide support? How much tuition? What the legislature did was to ensure that the children of divorced parents don't have to go through that. And that's why we have 2619090, which allows for trial courts to authorize post-secondary support under relevant circumstances. And here, you know, again, the father is trying to elevate form over substance. Sure, it was a motion for an adjustment and not a petition for modification. But again, what was the harm? They get a longer time period. He was offered a longer time period. It wasn't a two-week motion calendar. They noted it for 6 weeks. The trial court said, if you think you need more time, ask. They didn't ask. They shouldn't have had to show a substantial change in circumstance because, again, they've already considered that the children, it was contemplated. And all of the other considerations under 19090, which is, you know, where the parents...
Well, contemplated, let me pick a bone here. The court initially has four choices. It can deny it, it can grant it, and it can grant it with out setting an amount, or it can grant it setting an amount, or it can reserve it. So reserving it doesn't necessarily make a determination that the parties have agreed it should be ordered. It's merely agreed the court has the issue, has not decided the issue.
That's correct. And that's exactly, again, why we had to bring, the mother had to bring an action before the child turned, graduated from high school.
Right.
Those were the options before the trial court. The trial court was aware that, you know, she could just say no, the kids don't get any post-secondary support. She could have ordered that the kids, you know, pay for half of it. And in fact, what the trial court did is required the children to contribute to their personal expenses during this time. Those were all the options. But the point is, this wasn't an action where you needed to file a petition for a modification and go through the rigmarole of, you know, showing a substantial change in circumstance. And I think...
although you could have shown that.
Of course, yes. And I think the point is well made.
You could have said, I can't afford it now, and here are the financial records.
And that's exactly what the father did below, and the trial court disagreed. I mean, if you look at, you know, they come
so
here...
So is this form over substance? Was this, in fact, an opportunity to show that there had been a substantial change in circumstances?
Anything they could have done for the modification, they had the opportunity to do there. If he wanted to say, I'm a lot poorer than I thought I'd be, I've got a new child, I can't, you know, provide post-secondary support, he could have done that, and he did do that. And the trial court, within its discretion, within its fact-finding ability, looked at their financial declarations, looked at their incomes, and said, well, you know, times are tight, but I think you can do it. And in fact, he can do it. If you look at his financial declaration and his regular declaration, he says, I have net income of $8,500 a month. I have expenses of $6,000.
And did the trial court allow him additional time if he
yes.
wanted to have
yes.
additional time?
Yes. At the hearing, I think it's at RP-15. I might be wrong, but it's definitely in the transcript. Because the trial court noted, you know, well, I think this, and again, said, you know, I think this is just sort of form over substance. You know, the only difference I see is there's a longer time period. If you think you need more time, I could set this over.
Let's start where counsel started with this is too much. So let's assume we got past the procedural part and we got past the daughters are eligible and appropriate. Here we start with a downward deviation for the minor child who has the absolute priority for support. So there's a recognition that there's not the capacity. And then on top of it, the court orders post-secondary to be paid for both children. I mean, first place, the support for the minor child should be set first, and any deviation or any change offset ought to be to the older child. And he's challenging the amount as being excessive. Now, isn't this excessive? I mean, the statute says if you get past 45% or it's too much, it's excessive?
It's not beyond 45%. Again, you know, if you look at his financial declaration, he makes a net income of $8,500 a month. His regular monthly expenses are $6,000. He calculated in his declaration, said, if I have to pay post-secondary support for the UW for both my children at the same time, I'd be paying child support of $1,800 a month. He has a slush of $2,500 a month, and there's not many people that can actually say that they've got that amount. And the trial court said, again, within its discretion and within its fact-finding ability said, I think you could do it. Everyone has to tighten their belt. This is what parents do. I also want to address the father's asked for attorney's fees. There's no need and ability to pay. The fact of the matter, and unfortunately, if you look at their financial declarations that were filed in the court for fees here, between the two of them, they have paid over $24,000 in attorney fees addressing this issue. That's money that should have probably been better spent on the children's post-secondary support instead of litigating in this court. Unless the court has any further questions.
Yeah, but if parents were reasonable, there wouldn't be any family law.
I'd be out of a job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't want to spend any time on the arithmetic, but I do want to beg you to check the counsel's math. My client is on the edge. He's got $50,000 in debt. He doesn't have any way to come up with this money. When they do the math, they discount his debt payment. He borrowed the money to pay for this proceeding.
But we're working here. If we get to the calculation,
yeah.
This is an abuse of discretion. I mean, so
I
he's
know.
Either violated a statutory standard or he's abused his discretion. So you have to paint that picture. It's not just an upside. I mean, you know that.
Right, yeah. I think I know what you mean. I think I make the factual case persuasively just for the downward deviation. But let me get back to the procedural issue. And I just want to point out that the entire sort of thrust here is to shift the burden to my client, to insist, to demand that the court and the opposing parties comply with the law. And I think there's something fairly topsy-turvy about that. Now, form over substance, right. In the right cases, we want to, you know, beware of that. But the rules do matter, and they matter a lot in child support cases, in family law cases, for the clarity and the finality that they promise. The mother made a mistake here. She filed the wrong proceeding, and she waited until the very last day before the child graduated from high school and support terminated to do that. Now, somehow my client is supposed to just kind of suck that up, I guess. And you're supposed to fix that for her, for that mistake. And I just think there's a peril to broader principles here in asking you to do that, to fix the mistake that the mother made. Getting to the question of reserved, there's no evidence at all that they contemplated this matter in the record. There's just that it was reserved. Nothing was done. There's clearly no agreement that he's going to pay post-secondary educational support. He's just had a new baby. He's not going to sign on to that. And there's no evidence in the record about what they knew about the daughter's aptitudes in 2008 when the last order was entered. So there's no way in the world that the court in 2012 could find a substantial change of circumstances. And there's clearly no finding in 2008 that a substantial change of circumstances was done. And the legislature says one must be found to insert this obligation into an order.
Is it fair to say he's not disputing that his daughter fits the eligibility criteria or for the court to find she's an appropriate person? This is about procedurally correct and too much.
Well, I'm not going to concede there's a substantial change of circumstances proved. The court
I'm not saying that.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Just saying the question of whether or not the parents contemplated that their children might go to college and that she's college material, that appropriateness of award if we're not dealing with a change of circumstance.
Well, there's no evidence in 2008 what anybody knew about the girls. So I really don't have a response for that.
You know, he's not saying she's inappropriate as a college student.
They both got into UW.
Yeah.
I would be a fool to say that, to put those words in his mouth. It just didn't come up. You know, the fact of the matter is the court never made a finding.
I'm just trying to decide if it's challenged.
It didn't arise, so I guess not. Yeah, I'm sorry. It just hasn't come up. But it is the mother's burden to prove that, the substantial change of circumstances, and she didn't do that. And I just humbly, very humbly, respectfully say that it's not for this court to declare that there's no difference between a motion to adjust as a specific statutory procedure to petition modify. That's for the legislature to do. And again, I think there's some very important to make these rules as clear as possible. And so we ask that the order be vacated and the matter dismissed.
Clearly, there are two different proceedings. I think the question asked earlier is, but was there any difference in how this proceeding was conducted other than what it was initially filed?
Well, just, yes, the service of process time is different. There's no discovery. You know, they filed their initial pleadings. There's time limits on, or page limits on what you could file, time limits applied. You know, when he got to revision, he didn't ask for more time. You know, he has only so much money to spend on this, so.
But we're looking for prejudice. If, you know, did he get everything you would have had in a petition? And I guess what we were looking for in the briefing was, how was he prejudiced?
There's no real record about that in terms of the facts. There, the substantial change of circumstances, substantively, he was prejudiced. And I think the point I make in the brief is, he shouldn't have to show that. You know, that's not proper. So thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Court will be in recess.